I'm up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire, and I'm in the studio with my guest co-host, Marsha Hatfield Dottesdale.
Hi, Daniel.
Nice to have you again on the show, and today we're going to talk to Patricia Engel, whose new book, It's Not Love, It's Just Paris, has just come out to great reviews, and it's doing very, very well, and it'll be nice talking about her.
It's going to be interesting to talk to her since her first book, Vita, got so many awards and so much acclaim and was a New York Times notable book and a finalist for the Pen Faulkner.
And our poem of the week is going to be one of the prose poems from Charles Baudelaire. It's called, in English, Be Drunk.
Okay.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite poems. I remember when I had my 40th birthday party, I read this. You know,
yes, you did.
I was kind of drunk. You were there?
Yeah. Very memorable birthday for you. Yes, I was there.
Really? I didn't know we knew each other that long. We must be really good friends.
No, I was at your 50th birthday party.
50? I never turned 50.
Oh, you sure did. I was there. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, but I didn't
Wrong
read,
decade.
I didn't read Charles
No, you didn't
Baudelaire
read anything
the
there.
Yeah, yeah.
You were just charming. So.
Yeah, you know, it's my
50
natural
and all.
State, I think.
So, it's really apropos. We're talking about Paris, about a book in Paris, because I'm sure you remember this. But a couple of summers ago, you called me from Paris.
That's right. I was spending the summer in Paris, and I was waiting to hear from publishers about whether or not they wanted to publish Hotel Juarez.
And you had three offers already.
Three offers in the same week. Which
That's
I got them
right.
all when I was in Paris. I got an email one day from one, and I thought, all right, this is great. And then a couple of days later, I got another email, and then about 2-3 days later, I got another one. And so I had to choose between them.
It's an embarrassment of riches for any writer to get three offers in 1 week.
In Paris.
And in Paris. That's so incredibly
with
romantic.
The Eiffel Tower out my window.
Yeah, remember it was that hard view? To feel awesome. Sorry for you when you had this dilemma. Which of three publishers will I pick? And P.S., I'm standing over by the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, and so I called Marsha. You know, she knows about publishers. She's, you know, got a lot of experience. She's, in spite of the fact that she's often incredibly mean to me, she's a nice person, you know, and she's smart. I'm not nice. I guess that's really not the right way of saying it. So, but you're pretty smart when it comes to publishing. You've been in publishing for a long time. So I called you and I says, here's the three publishers and here's the three deals that they're giving me. And you pretty much told me it was a no-brainer.
Well, you found a happy home for Hotel Juarez.
Right.
I think you've been very pleased with Arte Publico. And considering the publishing program and mission that they're building over there, I just really thought that you know, you're not just an up-and-coming writer now.
Right.
You know, you're established. You're there. You know, you're on the ascendancy. You're not having to prove something with a first book or try to cap the first book with the second, which is hard. I think you found the right home. But it is hard to feel sorry for somebody that has offers from three publishers and is in Paris.
Yeah, and, you know, the cool thing is what really got us was they said they were going to come out with it like 3-4 months.
That's right.
Whereas the other ones, I would have had to wait a year or two before it came out.
Well, that's the thing also with regional presses and university presses. You know, there's a process. Some of them can move much more quickly. Others with limited resources have already got their publication schedule figured out for the next 2 years.
Well, you know, I'm really excited, Marsha, that you're co-hosting this show with me because I, you know, in spite of the fact, like I said, that you're kind of mean to me at times, I really like you. So thanks for being with us. And thank you for joining us. We'll be right back. Talk to Patricia Engel on her new book, It's Not Love, It's Just Paris.
Welcome back to Words on a Wire, and today I am the guest co-host with Daniel Chacon, and we are interviewing Patricia Engel, and she is the author of Vita, and her most recent book, It's Not Love, It's Just Paris. Now, Vita received incredible critical acclaim, and It's Not Love, It's Just Paris is now garnering the same sort of praise. The story is set in Paris, romantic, wonderful Paris. with a group of young women living in the house, well, grand mansion of an aging countess. Patricia was born to Colombian parents and raised in New Jersey, and she earned her undergraduate degree in French and art history at New York University and her MFA in fiction at Florida International University. She teaches creative writing at the University of Miami. Welcome to the show, Patricia.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on your new book, It's Not Love, It's Just Paris. It's a beautiful book. It's getting a lot of attention. It's getting great reviews. How did this book come about?
Well, I can say that it's a book that I've been living with for about 10 years before I actually sat down to write it. I majored in French literature in college, and I spent a lot of time in Paris, and I lived in Paris myself. So I always sort of had it in me that I always wanted to write the Paris novel that I felt was true to the Paris that I'd experienced and seen. And I also wanted to write a love story because I love love stories, and I sort of felt that love stories have gotten a bad rap in the world of literary fiction, and I also wanted to write a contemporary love story that was realistic and dealt with issues that young people face. And those were my two small goals when I set out to write it finally a few years ago.
Well, Patricia, I'm curious about this. I've seen interviews with quite a number of notable women authors that have said that they had a little difficulty clearing that invisible barrier that's called chick lit to literary fiction. Now, your first book, Vita, won so many awards and did so well. You didn't have to encounter that barrier, did you?
No, I know what you mean, though, and that was a concern of mine before my first book came out. I thought with the female narrator and female protagonist that possibly it wouldn't interest men, because men, I thought, were more attracted to male voices.
Right.
And I was very pleasantly surprised, because some of the first people who responded to it and told me that they liked it and they identified with the narrator were men of all ages and of all backgrounds.
That's good, because I know that one interview with Anne Tyler, she said that she was sort of shuffled off into that chick-lit oblivion until she won the Pulitzer Prize. That tends to take you out of that sort of a genre.
Tell us about the main character. How did she come about? Is she based on your own experience living in Paris?
Yes and no. I don't write autobiographically. I definitely am committed to the world of fiction. I love fiction. I find it so freeing. But I can't, you know, negate that I'm Colombian American, just like my narrator is. And also that I'm from New Jersey, of Colombian parents, right. And I moved to Paris. But I would say the similarities end there. Maybe what I did was I borrowed the set from experiences of my past, but the plot of the novel isn't entirely fictional.
Well, I noticed in your acknowledgments, Patricia, that it's especially for the real girls of Rue du Bac, uh-huh. that you had promised you would write this book. What happened to the real girls of Rue du Bac?
Well, yeah, there are some real girls of Rue du Bac, because the House of Stars, which is the boarding house owned by the countess who rents out rooms to the protagonist and to the other girls who figure in the novel, was inspired by a real place, a real house owned by a real countess. And just to show you how it deviates from real life, in actuality, the real countess passed away just a few weeks after I moved into that house, whereas the character of the countess is very prominent in the novel, so you can see she was entirely invented. So there were real girls of Rue du Bac, but there were 14 and not 7 or 8, as there are in the novel, and, you know, they've gone on to live lives all over the world. But, yeah, I did sort of write this novel out of love and affection for them.
I love the detail of the house itself. It's very old, elegant French, yet at the same time it's kind of fading away, which is very much like the Countess. But also it serves as a kind of a representation for what Paris is like to begin with. Is this detail true to the house itself, or is this just something of your imagination?
That part is sort of true to the house. It had seen better days, but it like you said, it does also sort of reflect some aspects of the city at large. Paris is a city that's grasping onto so much tradition, yet it's so subject to so many changes as a result of globalism and tourism and immigration. So it's really a city of contrasts.
Sometimes you get a sense of there's Paris and then there's Epcot Paris.
Yes. And I think you see that in literature, too.
And how did the literature of the American literature, specifically of Paris and Paris romance, did you have to resist that as you were writing? Did the forms of those stories kind of try to impose itself at times?
No. I was a French literature major, so I actually was more influenced by the literature of Paris written by the French or by, the French and the Occidental. So I would have to say the books that were sort of the forefathers of this novel were The Life Before Us by Romain Gary, who's one of my favorite writers, The Journals of Camus, who's also one of my favorites, the writings of Marguerite Duras, The Journals of Anaïs Nin, and if there's an American, some people would think that I'm about to say Hemingway, but probably James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room was one of my favorite books, and that's one that I kept close to me.
Well, I definitely wouldn't have guessed Hemingway, for sure.
Well, I did notice, too, Patricia, this isn't a book that you just skim through. I'm happily enmeshed in it right now, and it's the sort of book that certain phrases and sentences catch you and hold you for a while. I know that one that I found very interesting was the statement that the brown American dream is the white American nightmare. Could you kind of enlarge on that for us?
Sure. Thank you for the compliments first. Yeah, that's a line that's said by the narrator Lita's older brother, Santi, who is sort of extremist in his views, you could say. But I thought it was important to include a character like that because there are a lot of people who think that and a lot of people who sort of absorb that feeling from the world around them, that there's a resentment that first and second generation Americans live with and a resentment that they feel from society for their success.
That's interesting. I've spent some time in Paris as well. I mean, like 3 months here and a couple of months there, not as much as you, and I didn't study French literature, although I tried to dabble in Baudelaire and classics like that. But I remember I was walking in, I think it was Montmartre, and there was a bank, and there was graffiti on the bank, and it said, I'm going to say it in French, but my French is really horrible, so you can correct my pronunciation if you'd like. But it said, notre rêve est votre cauchemar.
Mm-hmm. Our dream, your nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. And I would see that around the city a lot, and there seemed to be, as a Chicano man, I would notice that the tension with the Arabic youth, second generation Arabic youth, and the white French seemed to be. I don't know if everybody notices that, but is that something that plays into your perception of France?
Yeah, France is interesting to me because their immigration discussion is a bit different from ours here in the United States, and that's another reason why I chose to sort of displace my characters, not just write about Latinos in the U.S. again, but place them elsewhere. And it's because of that. The tension is really on the surface there, as you noticed while you were there. And it's a bit different, It's certainly focused more towards North Africa. But it was very interesting to me.
Are you on a book tour right now? Where are you going, and how are you enjoying all the? Are you enjoying the success of this book? Because it's doing very well.
Oh, thank you. The book came out at the beginning of August, so right away I was traveling around Florida and the East Coast, and then in September I went out west, and I was up and down the West Coast, and I came back, and I was in Atlanta, New Orleans, and before I came back down to Florida. So the bulk of the traveling is pretty much behind me now. I've just got a few more events here and there.
Mm. I'm going to coattail on something Marcia said. She was talking about how you don't want to rush through this book. It is the kind of book that you kind of like to linger in and be there. And is there any plans, or has your agent had any success at all of selling the movie options or the movie rights?
The option for my first book was sold right away. So my first book, Vida, still, optioned for film. But this one so far, no. I think it would make a great movie, too, but hasn't happened yet.
Patricia, in Hollywood, when they say you're an overnight success, and it may have taken 20 years to get to that overnight success, how long had you been writing, of course, you had short stories published in many publications. But is this something you started very young?
Yeah, I've been writing since I've known how to write. I grew up in a family of artists, painters and musicians, and my grandmother used to write, but privately. She never shared her writing. So I was always writing. I used to draw pictures, and then as soon as I learned how to make sentences, I would make captions for the pictures, and then, you know, the captions grew longer and longer into stories. That's how it started. I also always kept journals and wrote really to keep myself company. I was, you know, kind of a quiet kid for the most part, and I just did it to entertain myself. I was not one of those kids who stood out or was winning contests or was like, look what I wrote. No, that was not me. So, like I said, in college I majored in art history and French literature, and I was still just writing on the side. And I always thought, because all the artists that I knew all had day jobs, I just thought, you know, you had a job and you would, you know, do your art on the side. And it wasn't until several years after college, when I was working a variety of jobs and taking writing workshops at night and on the weekends and things, that I started to do a little bit of research and I learned about MFA programs, which I was not aware of before that. Mm-hmm. And I applied to graduate school just because I wanted the excuse of having a few solid years to devote to my writing in order to justify quitting my job. And that's what I did, and I would say that's where, you know, things started to get serious for me.
And what was your day job before you got into...
I had many. My first job out of college was working in the art business, in art dealing at an auction house, and then I worked in real estate and graphic design, in marketing. I worked at an investment bank, you name it.
Well, right now, Patricia, there's a book that's been kind of popular. It's called The Process, and it takes writers from all sorts of walks of life, genres, living, dead, and it talks about the process that they had to write. Do you have a ritual sort of thing to sit down to write? Is it every day? What do you do?
I don't think it's a ritual. I've just sort of maybe developed some habits. There are times when life affords me the freedom of working every day, but usually there's something that comes up that messes up my day, and that can't happen. But on a good writing day, I would say just on the physical aspects, I tend to write in silence, not with music or anything. I like to write by natural light, which means I don't usually write at night. And I usually write at, you know, at my dining room table or something like that.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I don't like to write. Well, you know, I write in the mornings, and I like to write near a window, and I don't like to have lights on, actually. But I do like it to have a lot of light.
Yeah, the same for me.
And do you write every day once you're in a project?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I would have to say, when I'm deep in a novel, like I was with this one, it sort of hijacks your life in a way. So even if you're not physically at the desk every day writing, it's still occupying your attention, you know, almost 100%. So I can say that even if I'm not physically typing or in front of the screen, I'm living with the novel in a way where it feels like I'm writing every day.
Right. Even taking a walk can be writing.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Absolutely. I totally agree. In fact, I sometimes say, well, I've written for, you know, 4 hours today, but actually butt time might have only been half an hour.
Exactly. Yeah.
Did you find that any of your characters in this book sort of hijacked their own story? Did any of them turn out differently than what you started off imagining?
Well, characters grow and change as you're writing a book, and they're definitely not what they started out as in the early drafts of the book. So I can say that they all sort of came to be who they wanted to be in the novel, all of them. It would be hard to identify just one. I think that they all sort of came into their own process of evolution.
We're talking to Patricia Engel, of the author of It's Not Love, It's Just Paris. One of the things that Ben and I always talk about with writers is, do you have, before you start writing, do you have the ending?
I have an idea of the ending, but it's not so literal. I can't even describe it in words or images. It's just sort of an emotional note.
Oh, wow.
So it's not articulated at all. It's just sort of this feeling that I have of where I want the novel to take the reader, and then I just sort of have to figure out my way to hit those notes.
Do you just know in your gut when you reach that note?
I would have to say I know in my gut when I don't reach it.
That's a good answer.
And then I just keep going and going and going until I don't get that feeling anymore. Like, it's wrong, it's wrong,
right.
It's wrong.
That's amazing. That's interesting. Because, yeah, a lot of novelists I know, they have the exact last image, even if they don't know what the image means. But I like that idea of the note. Mm-hmm. This is your second novel. Is it really your second novel, or are there like mutant novels inside your hard drives that never made it?
Well, this one is a novel that I wrote 10 times before, so I feel like I've written 10 other novels. But really, I was just writing the same one over and over again. And that happens. That happens also with short stories. Sometimes I'm writing a story, and then it's done, and I realize I've written this story, you know, 5 different ways already. So I think there's stories that haunt you until you get them right.
Are you going to come up with a collection of stories soon?
Well, some people would say that my first book was a collection of stories, but I'm with you. It's sort of a novel-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm always working on other stories, so I hope one day to have a collection.
And what are you working on now?
I'm getting another novel off the ground now. Hopefully, you know, I'll stick with that for a while, and it'll lead to something.
It is a remarkable book, and you did manage to take the reader there to that emotional note, but as I say, I'm still enmeshed in it and taking my time.
Well, thank you.
It's a fun ride. Thank you, Patricia, for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you. It was great to speak to you both.
This is Benjamin Alida Sines for Words on a Wire. This is the first of a series on some meditations that I wrote entitled Words, Language, Memory. I know there are countless and competing theories about language, about what it is, what it does, where it originates in the brain, where it originates in the various cultures where it appears, and how it operates. There are even more theories about the function of memory. Of memory, I have this to say. Memory is as unreliable as it is necessary for human existence. That is what makes Alzheimer's such a heartbreaking disease. As to the theories about language, well, I'm a writer, not a linguistics professor. I'm interested in words and language and memory, not as a scientist, but as an artist. As such, I am obsessed with words and memory with regards to how they function in my body and in my body of work. I know each particular language has its own particular history. Each language creates words and puts the words together systematically to create meaning. But every language has a context, the particulars of the surrounding landscape. I am obsessed with meaning and how it is created and how it makes possible the things we call the imagination. I very much doubt that the imagination could exist without language. Cynics argue that meaning is merely a construction. That may be true. But the house I live in is also a construction. I happen to need it. I happen to believe that language gives order to the chaos. Language is the angel that hovers over the chaos of the waters and creates a world. Having lived in and out of chaos most of my life, I think I prefer order. I cannot live in chaos. I have always thought of words as a way to translate the world precisely because the world is so overwhelmingly vast and large, and I am so puny and small. Translating the world into pieces we can digest is not a hobby, but a necessity for survival. I have to do something to make myself feel a part of the overwhelming universe. Words are more than mere labels. They are representations of the material, of the tangible. Words make the inaccessible accessible. Words express complicated emotional, intellectual, and sensual realities. but I'd like to think that words are more than tools we use to explain the phenomena around us. Some would argue that words are poor substitutes for true experience, whatever that is. And while it is true that I would rather have sex than look up its etymology in the Oxford English Dictionary, I would argue that we need the word sex just as much as we have a desire to engage in it. We need experience, but we also need a way to express those experiences. And this despite the fact that our linguistic expressions at times fall short. When we experience something, anything, we need to communicate that experience, or those experiences will be lost. Not to be able to communicate what we are living and learning is to begin to die. I choose to live. I don't know how to live without words. And what is more, I can't live without words. A world without words? I don't want to live in that world. For Words on a Wire, this is Benjamin Alire Sáenz.
For the poem of the week, I am going to read a Parisian poem by Charles Baudelaire. It's actually one of his prose poems, and I would read it in French, but my accent is so horrible that I'm going to go ahead and just do it in English. And the English translation is entitled Be Drunk. In French, it's Enivrez-vous. Be drunk. You have to always be drunk. That's all there is to it. It's the only way. So as not to feel the horrible burden of time that breaks your back and bends you to the earth, you have to be continually drunk. But on what? Wine, poetry, or virtue, as you wish, but be drunk. And if sometimes, on the steps of a palace or the green grass of a ditch, in the mournful solitude of your room, you wake again, drunkenness already diminishing or gone, ask the wind, the wave, the star, the bird, the clock, everything that is flying, everything that is groaning, everything that is rolling, everything that is singing, everything that is speaking. Ask what time it is, and wind, wave, star, bird, clock will answer you, it's time to be drunk. So as not to be the martyred slaves of time, be drunk, be continually drunk, on wine, on poetry, or on virtue, as you wish. That was Be Drunk by Charles Baudelaire.
What a great way to end the show. I think we should be paying attention to this advice. It's time for wine and song.
All right, let's do it. I got a bottle in my bag. Thank you for joining us for Words on a Wire. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Marcia Hatfield-Dottiston.
And we'll see you next week. And don't forget,
the next book you read
could save your life or get you drunk.
Don't know what I'm gonna do about my failing health. Sit back, have a drink, and blame my failing wealth. No longer can't afford the booze that is the best. I think I'll ramble, get away from all this mess. Gonna ride that same old rail, Night Train Express. 'Cause I'm a designated drinker. Reckon by default, I'm the designated drinker.